Before we start, I just want to acknowledge the thanks of Judge Tinder and myself for the presence of Judge Tharp of the Northern District of Illinois, who is we are privileged to have sit with us today and grace this bench.
Pleasure to be here.
The first case for argument this morning, Doe versus Prosecutor Marion County, Mr. Falk.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court. The statute in this case, Indiana Code 3542-4-12, applies to most persons who have committed sex offenses against children in Indiana and who are required to register, and it even applies against some persons who have committed adult offenses. The statute prohibits these persons from ever accessing any social media to which children have access or which children may use. The reality of social media and the ability to log on by lying about your age means that, in effect, this statute prohibits those persons covered from ever accessing any social media. The purpose of this statute is to protect children from online social media sexual predators. However, the trial court readily acknowledged that the statute captures considerable conduct which has nothing to do with communicating with children. The statute, although content neutral, is unconstitutional because it is not narrowly tailored, it is substantially overbroad, and it fails to leave open ample alternative channels of communication.
Mr. Falk, when you say overbroad, are you saying that it affects others besides Doe, impinges on their rights, or are you saying that, what do you mean by overbroad?
Well, Your Honor, in this context where we have Mr. Doe asserting, I believe, the full spectrum of rights, also representing a class, asserting the full spectrum of rights, the overbreadth analysis is identical to that of narrow tailoring. Both of these analyses ask, in this instance, does this statute burden substantially more protected activity than is necessary to satisfy its admittedly compelling purpose of protecting children from online harm?
Protected activity of the class.
Exactly, Your Honor. Substantial overbreadth is often used as a standing expander, in effect. That's not necessary here. Therefore, I think it's quite clear from this Court's prior cases that the two analyses merge. And the problem, of course, is that the trial court, and that was a quote I just gave the Court, specifically said the statute captures considerable conduct that has nothing to do with interacting with minors. The statute encompasses a huge swath of legitimate activity that has nothing to do with interacting with minors at all. Moreover, the statute applies to persons who were never convicted of any offense involving social media or even the Internet.
On that last point, Mr. Falk, what if we had a situation where we had an individual who had been convicted using the social media? Would you say it would be unconstitutional to make that a provision of a sentence, the preclusion of entry onto social media?
What I think there we have to look at this Court's and other cases about parole conditions, where we're dealing with the United States parole statute, which requires a reasonable conditions. And I think what this Court has said for purposes of supervised release, and of course in this case, our case, we're dealing with people who are not on supervised release. But even if you're on supervised release, you have to narrowly tailor that. So I would say there might very well be situations in sentencing where you could narrowly tailor the punishment if the statute allowed it. The problem with this statute, however, is that you could have been convicted 30 years ago of rape against an adult. You're on the registry in Indiana. You are banned for life, assuming that you have to register for life, as many offenders like Mr. Doe does. You are banned from life from this whole swath of social media, which now, of course, is the modern form of communication. And that simply is too broad. And, of course, the burden is on the prosecutor to demonstrate narrow tailoring, and I don't think the prosecutor even attempted that here, Your Honor. And I think if we look at Indiana law, what we have in Indiana law now is we have a criminal statute that prohibits solicitation of children, including the Internet, or attempted solicitation. We then have a statute that prohibits inappropriate communications for a sexual purpose on the Internet. These statutes are narrowly tailored to get at the specific conduct which the challenge statute is supposed to get at, online sexual predators on social media. But these other statutes do it in a way without encompassing any protected conduct. To the contrary, with our statute, almost all the conduct is protected. And that simply does not satisfy any notion of narrow tailoring or substantial overbreadth.
Recognizing that it's not your burden, and recognizing there are other statutes out there that might overlap in terms of their objectives and purposes, are there ways to more narrowly tailor the statute, in your view, that the Indiana legislature could have availed itself of?
Well, not surprisingly, the Indiana legislature does not frequently consult with the American Civil Liberties Union of Indiana for legislative guidance. But obviously, and I'm reluctant to sort of off-the-cuff respond, but I think obviously we'd have to look at something more narrowly tailored, a sentencing option, someone who is a repeat sexual offender on social media. You could build into punishment, recognizing it could not probably be retroactive under ex post facto analysis, you could build into future punishment some sort of additional punishment besides incarceration of loss of some privileges. But again, what we have here is the exact opposite. What we have here is the state of Indiana saying, we think there's a problem, we're going to just ban everyone for many of them, forever, from ever accessing social media. And if narrow tailoring is to mean anything at all, this definitely is not narrowly tailored. It also does not leave open ample alternative channels of communication, recognizing, of course, that your alternatives not have to be the best alternative or your first choice. It does have to allow you to reach your intended audience. And given the reality of social media, the ability to, in real time, communicate over different platforms with numerous persons across the country, there really is no other alternative.
Well, there is email, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And the persons covered by the statute have access to the non-interactive sites, new information sites.
That's correct.
On Drudge Report, et cetera.
That's correct.
They can gather information. Right?
They can gather information, but communication is more difficult. And you know, we gave some examples in our brief and below. If you're working on a national political campaign, you're networking with volunteers from around the country, you're exchanging video and audio and discussing things back and forth, you really have to do that through social media. The Arab Spring, of course, was enabled by social media, by the ability on Twitter to instantaneously respond back and forth. All that is lost, and we believe there are no alternative channels. But again, I don't think we have to go there. I think this case stops, begins and ends at the notion of narrow tailoring, and this certainly is not a narrow tailoring.
Are we at the stage of communication today where you would equate this with a ban on making phone calls?
Well, for many, I believe that would be the case. I think the evidence was roughly a little bit less than 50% of Indiana, the total population, is on Facebook. The numbers are staggering, 100 million people in the United States on Twitter. There are people now who get their news, get their information from social media. As we noted in our material, our evidentiary material, if you want to respond to a comment, or you want to make a comment to an Indianapolis Star article now, you have to do it through Facebook. And you do that instantaneously, and you get into a dialogue with other people responding back and forth. But without access to that social media platform, you have no ability to communicate. You can't call anyone, in essence.
This is perhaps a statutory construction issue that wasn't reached, but it seems to me you argue in your brief that this concept of allowing a person less than 18 to have access,
yes,
that there are ways to get around that for a minor, and that could still be considered to be allowed. Is that what that statute means? Does it mean that someone can get to it, or does this, if the service says if you're under 18 you can't use it?
Well, Your Honor, I don't know what it means. If you look at subsection F, which is a defense, there's a defense if the person did not know that that persons under the age of 18 were allowed access. That defense doesn't make any sense if the initial defense is, hey, I'm on a site that is only for persons 18 or older. But more importantly, Your Honor, again, the evidence, the record doesn't reflect the requirements for all social media, but the only social media outlet that the record discusses restricting to 18 or over is LinkedIn, which you can still create public profiles that you have access to even though you're under 18. Twitter, and Facebook are both, I believe, 13 or older, according to the record. So I think, regardless of how you interpret that, we're still talking about a huge, huge amount of social media to which these persons are excluded. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Falk. Ms. Barrow?
May it please the Court? Plaintiffs have not challenged the reality that predators on the Internet search victims, most likely, most often young, vulnerable victims. This court frequently addresses this reality in criminal appeals, including earlier this year in U.S. versus Hensel, a case where a defendant from Illinois befriended a 12-year-old Indiana girl through a chat room. He pretended to be a 14-year-old boy. When they met, the girl was shocked that he was much older.
Of course, that wouldn't have fit under this statute anyway. He was in Illinois.
Well,
the statute only applies to Indiana residents, I assume.
The significance of the Illinois-Indiana was the particular statute under which he was convicted, having to do with crossing state lines. The facts, though, could happen just even within state.
Sure.
The fact that somebody pretends to be a young person to gain the trust of somebody, and then they meet, and even though she resisted his advances, he forced her to go to a hotel room, fed her alcohol, marijuana, forced her to have sex, and as a result, you know, committed serious crimes.
But there's probably an infinite number of crimes that have been committed using an infinite number of communication devices. That doesn't necessarily imply that you can prohibit the use of every communication device that's been used to commit a crime.
That's true. The features of the social media that are prohibited are such that they do permit the anonymity that you can achieve on the Internet. They do have the interactiveness where
and
you can gain
Barrow,
somebody's trust.
Would you agree that it was your burden at the trial court to show the narrow tailoring and alternative means for
Correct.
The statute? You do agree that it affects speech?
Yes. It implicates speech, but the district court correctly held that it did not violate the class's First Amendment rights.
Do you agree with the district court's conclusion that the statute captures considerably more conduct that doesn't have anything to do with the potential interaction with children?
Correct. However, that is where the ample alternative means become very significant. What we're looking at is, for example, John Doe in his affidavits, the way he would choose to use social media, particularly Facebook. His case is about Facebook. He says that he wants to communicate with the Pilots Association. But he doesn't show that association is impossible absent Facebook. Don't they have a website? I visited the website. Don't they have email? He can still communicate with the association and other members.
But that's the adequacy prong. Word goes to whether the statute's narrowly tailored. And if you agree with the district court that the statute captures conduct, a substantial amount of conduct that has nothing to do with the object of preventing insidious communications with children, doesn't that end the inquiry under Ward?
No, it doesn't, to the extent that there are still alternate channels of communication.
Any alternate means? They've got to be adequate.
Well, what the distinction that the plaintiffs are making, it has to do with speed, has to do with interactiveness. The Indianapolis Star is an example. If you're reading a story online and want to comment, they make you do it through Facebook. However, you can still send an email to the reporter. You can still write a letter to the editor. They are putting that distinction at a level of a constitutional right to a speedy, interactive experience with the Indianapolis Star and other readers.
But that is now the forum, isn't it? Isn't that how people communicate? The writing each other postcards can still be done, I agree, but in today's world, everything is interactive.
Not necessarily.
When fewer... The affidavits from Professor Kate and the other professors laid out a pretty impressive explanation of how people communicate in today's world.
Yes, those affidavits certainly from professors whose specialty is internet communication depicted a world where it appeared everyone was on Facebook and used this kind of media, where at the same time the evidence shows that in Indiana fewer than 50% at least are on Facebook. So I think from the standpoint of the Indiana legislature...
You're confirming Judge Flom's view of Hoosiers right there.
Well,
he thinks we all wear bib overalls and travel by wagon.
I can tell you, Mr. Falk and I don't use Facebook, and here we are talking about this statute. So, but seriously, the fact that, you know, more than 50% of Hoosiers get by very well without Facebook... And
so
yet there are those.
Are we going to have to revisit this statute in 2 years or 5 years and assess the penetration of internet and social media sites at that point?
Not necessarily. And I think we're looking at fundamental principles here. So much in the world of sex offender legislation appears to be fluid. At the outset of sex offender registration legislation, as I understand it, that was preceded by empirical studies to show the risk of reoffending on the part of sex offenders. Has that changed? I mean, that was years ago. And if it's changed, has it been because of these regulations that require sex offenders to register? It does appear to be a fluid situation. What this statute represents is the concern of the legislature that serious crimes occur and that they're only targeting people who have to register as sex offenders, even though they're not on supervised release, even though they're not on parole or probation. They are still in a fundamentally different position in society than other citizens, to the extent their information is posted on the internet, their photographs, their description, their crimes. They have to register in every county where they do business, where they live, where they go to school, or they own property. They have to register if they go someplace for more than 7 days, like even on a vacation. These are significant infringements on their lives, on their liberty. They can't
almost
live.
Cut the other way? I mean, we've got all these safeguards in place. Why do we need what is arguably an incredibly expansive additional safeguard on top of all of these other things?
Well, there is an Indiana statute that, for example, requires sex offenders as part of the registration requirement to provide their internet identifiers, log-on information. And that, on its face, it applies to everybody, whether or not you're on supervised release. Judge Hamilton, however, enjoined the state from applying that statute to people on unsupervised release. So what might have been a more narrowly tailored way of monitoring internet use is no longer available as to this plaintiff class. And so to the extent that these are people who, by committing serious sex offenses against children, have already permanently forfeited significant rights in the community.
But it's beyond that. These are not just offenders against children. This includes adult-on-adult sex offenders if it's a violent crime, I think rape and criminal deviant conduct, if I recall.
Right, the list of offenses.
It goes beyond.
Correct.
And what showing is there that adult-on-adult offenders pose that risk of trolling for minors?
Well, there's... We did not, in the course of briefing and the arguments in the district court, did not pursue that particular angle of the case, that the statute does capture offenses against adults. In the state's brief, we did cite a case from this court where a person who had committed offense against an adult committed a subsequent offense against a child of a different gender. So the reality of crossover behaviors does exist, but this was not an issue that was developed in the briefing.
Isn't that the subject of Mr. Falk's objection to the consideration by the district court of a publication? Well, I guess I can take that up with him.
That had to do with the risk of reoffending. And the plaintiffs complained that that was a matter not out in the record.
Ms. Barrow, I made inquiry of Mr. Falk of whether Facebook had reached the equivalency of a phone call for so many. So if we would assume that half of adults in Indiana use Facebook or close to that, would you say that this legislature could, and I don't know whether you accept Facebook for those folks replacing the phone as a means of communication, could they ban the use of the phone for the individuals covered in this statute?
I don't see a statute that imposed a class-wide ban on telephone use. The ban in place here is attached to a more insidious type of communication that is proved to have devastating consequences when used against children.
We have cases where the phone has been used by law enforcement to ensnare would-be predators. That is a communication that is clearly people who are inclined to be sexual predators don't preclude the use of a phone.
That's true, and apparently telephones can be used to get access to the social media
right. That
is of concern in this case. In a nutshell, the legislature has seen this as a serious problem, the fact that the anonymity provided by social media, the access to children, specifically vulnerable children who are susceptible to people befriending them, is of concern, and that people who register as sex offenders have already committed serious sexual offenses, for the vast majority of them against children. And so to the extent that the plaintiffs are denied the speed with which they want to communicate, the interactiveness that they desire, that is part of the price that they have paid in committing their crimes.
Are you making that the equivalent of being banned from parks and school near close to school?
It is different to the extent if your residence can't be within 1,000 feet of a school. That has serious effects on your life if you have to leave the home you own for 20 years. That doesn't mean that the statute says you can't visit the park. And so I'm not drawing a total analogy to that, except that the residency restriction is a serious restriction on freedom. And it's this kind of restriction that is part of the policy-making ability of the legislature that this court must respect. And so I'd ask this court to affirm.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Barrow. Ms. Falk?
Thank you. I would note that the residency restriction or being banned from the park does not implicate First Amendment interest. And the minute you implicate First Amendment interest, we have to discuss narrow tailoring. Now, the prosecutor urges this court to ignore narrow tailoring and look only at ample alternatives. But these are two separate tests. If it is not narrowly tailored, it doesn't make any difference if there are ample alternatives. You could not, for instance, say, here's this little park. You're not allowed to have First Amendment activity here, but you can go to all the other parks in the city and have First Amendment activity because you have an ample alternative. We'd have to ask, is that narrowly tailored? Is that substantially overbroad? And it clearly is. The example that Ms. Barrow gave about the case of the person soliciting someone from Illinois to come, soliciting someone in Indiana to come to Illinois, well, that would be, assuming it happened in Indiana, would be a crime. It would be solicitation. It would probably even be a crime before the act of solicitation, the minute he sent an inappropriate communication designed for sexual purposes. Those are already crimes. There's no denying that there are bad people on the Internet. There are bad people on social media. That's why Indiana already has narrowly tailored crimes. The problem in this case is the prosecutor has not once explained how this statute adds anything more in protecting children. And that's, at a minimum, is what we should be asking. But if you focus on from a narrow tailoring point of view, remember, you are on the registry in Indiana potentially for crimes you committed years ago. There are ways, due to a state constitutional case involving ex post facto analysis to get your name off the registry if you so choose. But you could be on it for committing a crime 20, 25 years ago. And since this includes sexually violent predators not only are those who commit rape or criminal deviant conduct, but also those who have had two or more unrelated sex crimes. So you could be convicted twice of promoting prostitution. You are banned forever, at least as long as you have to register. And registration does not mean a stripping of your civil rights. Registration is an incursion, obviously, but it does not open up the state to adding on more and more requirements. And that is exactly what the state has done here with this statute, which is clearly not narrowly tailored. It was conceded as such by the trial court.
I'm curious about article that you complain about that Judge Pratt cited, and I guess I had that wrong in terms of the subject. It's about the likelihood of recidivism.
What this was a study that was not introduced by the state, which indicates that it's a 2006 report that reported that 1 in 7 youths has received online sexual solicitation, and 1 in 3 has received online exposure to unwanted sexual material.
Okay. So, and I know that that was not part of the record, the judge made reference to that, but that's not really a matter in dispute. You agree that,
yes, Your Honor,
that there is a lot of trolling and,
of course, Your Honor,
and bad conduct.
Of course, Your Honor, and that's why Indiana already has in place a law that, as I said, not only bans solicitation or attempted solicitation, but bans even inappropriate communications. Thank you.
Thanks, Rob. Thank you, Ms. Barrow. The case is